Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We'll see you back.
Stop with that, please, Cyrus. First thing in the morning.
I'm just saying welcome back. That's all.
Yeah.
I'm happy you're back.
Jar Jar Binks has no place on this program. Zero place. Hey, welcome, everybody. This is the Patrick Madrid Show. I am tanned, rested, and ready after a couple of days of R&R. That's all it was, but I was touched that some of you were... How did you put it, Cyrus? Some people were contacting the studio.
Some people were concerned. Okay. Concerned okay? Might be a good word for it. Is Patrick
okay? Ferris Bueller. It's like Ferris Bueller. You got the whole town worried that Ferris Bueller is going to be okay. But I wasn't playing hooky, so nothing like that. I just had a couple days of R&R, and I feel great. And I think my voice is better than it was before. Well, so welcome to the program. And Cyrus, Father Matthew Spencer, as ever, did a great job.
He did a great job. He's so awesome. They should give him his own show.
Oh, I know they've tried. I mean, he used to have his own show here on.
That's right.
It was actually on a Macintosh radio before the merger, and then briefly for the for Relevant Radio. But he's just so busy with. I believe he's the provincial superior for his congregation. So he has lots of work to do. So it's always really a great get when we can get him to fill in for me.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, so he's very generous with his time.
Yeah, and he does such a great job. So, yeah, I mean, if he finds that they no longer keep reelecting him to this high office that he's in, maybe he'll have more time and he can get back to the microphone more regularly here on Relevant Radio. So thanks to you, Father Matthew. I sure appreciate you being here for me. And thanks to all of you who are needlessly concerned about me. I'm great. Thanks be to God. And we're going to do a show like, I try to take this approach every single day, a show like no other. They have a life of their own, don't they? 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Now, I've shared with you before, I want to get into something that the Archdiocese of Milwaukee posted that is, it shouldn't be a bombshell for some people. It's this really offensive thing. I think it's great, and I'll explain why. But... you know, for the last several years running, that it's becoming more and more commonplace for people to give their pronouns. So I see it in social media profiles. And I will admit, Cyrus, when I see, like on Twitter, for example, if somebody is unironically putting he, him, she, her, they, them in the social media profile, my initial reaction is, I don't care about anything you might have to say about anything if you make that kind of a dumb decision. And all I have to do is sort of glance to see, like, what are they yammering on about? And sometimes I just say, you know, I think you just need to be muted. You know, I don't know if you take that approach proactively. Sometimes I do. And it's the gender pronouns that are indicative of people who are going along to get along. In some cases, they probably believe in this ideology. In other cases, maybe they don't believe in it, but they figure, you know, I don't want the wear and tear. I don't want to have to deal with people giving me a hard time. I don't want to be, you know, I don't want the Twitter mob to come after me. So they just capitulate and they start using the preferred pronouns. You can tell what my preferred pronouns are simply by looking at me. I'm a man. So he, him, those are the preferred pronouns for men. And you may say, well, what about Leah Thompson, the swimmer for Penn? Well, we'll get into that. We have some stories about that, Cyrus. I don't know if you knew that, but we're going to talk a little bit about that later in the program today. Cyrus is just keeping his head down. So here is the statement that came out from the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. And I'll tell you right up front, not to prejudice your reception of it, but just to say, I think this is good and helpful and welcome, given all the craziness that's going on around us right now. So the title of this document, I'm going to read it to you. I have time to do that in the first segment. And you have time to dial me up if you want to talk about this or anything else. The number again, 888-914-9149. 9149, 888-914-9149. So the title of this document is Catechesis and Policy on Questions Concerning Gender Theory. Now, policy is a big part of this. In other words, since the Archdiocese administers many different schools, K through 12, and for that matter also higher education as well, hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, there are many different facets of archdioceses in general, and that would be true of dioceses in some cases. So there are many different aspects of what go on in the archdiocese under which umbrella a document like this would pertain in terms of the policy for employees, etc. So this is the preface. The truth will set you free. Christ's words to his disciples call Christians in every age to embrace the truth of who we are as children of God. For only in embracing the truth can we be set free. This is Christ's promise to which Catholics assent with mind and heart, and this promise is the foundation of the Church's moral teachings. The Second Vatican Council stated that, quote, inspired by no earthly ambition, the Church seeks but a solitary goal, to carry forth the work of Christ under the lead of the befriending Spirit. And Christ entered this world to give witness to the truth, to rescue and not to sit in judgment, to serve and not to be served. To carry out such a task, the Church has always had the duty of scrutinizing the signs of the times and of interpreting them in light of the gospel. Thus, in language intelligible to each generation, she can respond to the perennial questions which men ask about this present life and the life to come, and about the relationship of one to the other. We must, therefore, recognize and understand the world in which we live, its explanations, its longings, and its often dramatic characteristics. Now, please note that throughout this document that I'm going to read to you verbatim, there are a number of footnotes that will help to clarify or expand upon certain things that are being said in the text. So I would refer you to the document, which Cyrus is going to post on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. It's also available on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. You can see it on the lower left there, and it would be worth your time to print it out, maybe email it to friends, what have you. But the footnotes give more detail. So with that commentary about the signs of the times and each generation having to deal with their own circumstances, it proceeds saying, each generation presents moral challenges to which the Church must respond as mother and as teacher. It is ever the duty of the Church both to listen patiently to the struggles of her children and also to instruct them clearly on the path to the fullness of life and freedom. As Pope Paul VI writes, it's an outstanding manifestation of charity toward souls to omit nothing from the saving doctrine of Christ. In the past decade, there has been increased attention paid to gender dysphoria and gender discordance, especially among children and young children and adolescents, coupled with the widespread notion that the solution to such dysphoria is to affirm one's gender experience, and that's in quote marks, over against one's biological sex. This prompts the Church to provide catechesis and policy for all the faithful, and especially for Church employees, personnel, and all others who work in parishes, organizations, and institutions of the Catholic Church in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. The Church teaches that the human person created in the image and likeness of God is a unified creature composed of body and soul. The soul is the spiritual principle of each human person and the subject of human consciousness and freedom. Yet man is truly himself only when his body and soul are intimately united. The human person is not a soul or a mind that has a body, merely as a biological accessory. Rather, the human person is a body formed by a soul. Human life and love are always lived out in body and spirit, and thus, the body is a vital expression of our whole being. I'm going to repeat that phrase because it's so fundamentally important. They're getting into human anthropology here. Basic human anthropology that a lot of people just have never heard about. So let me reread this sentence. So, let's see. It says, human life and love are always lived out in body and spirit, and thus the body, your body, is a vital expression of our whole being. I'll add, your body is a vital expression of your whole being. So integral, in fact, is the body to who we are as human beings, that the body and soul together are fashioned and destined to live forever. The creed expresses a belief in the resurrection of the body, or the belief that all persons will rise again with their own bodies, which they now bear. The body which will one day rise is the very body which each person received as a gift, and in which each person lives out his vocation to holiness. Our biological sex, expressed by our bodies, is a gift from God and is unchangeable. Let's repeat that. I'm going to make it more personalistic to you. Your biological sex, expressed by your body, is a gift from God and is unchangeable. A person's biological sex is expressed in and through the body. It cannot be changed, because it is bestowed by God as a gift and as a calling. And the gifts and the call of God are irrevocable, quoting Scripture. Biological sex, and this here is referring to sex as in you are male or you are female. Biological sex is a gift, because in the very act of creation, God bestows upon each human being a biological sex. Male and female, he created them, as it says in Genesis. Two sexes that are different, equal, and complementary. It is a calling because we work out our salvation via our masculinity or femininity. In other words, human persons do not experience the freedom and joy of salvation despite their biological sex, but only in it and through it. A person's quote-unquote gender is inseparable from biological sex. Now, that statement right there is enough to get you canned on Twitter. Please understand, that statement right there is enough to get you deplatformed nowadays, because that is the heresy of heresies in the eyes of countless people nowadays who have been so addled by gender ideology that they can't even bring themselves to acknowledge a simple and self-evident truth.
Yes, that's true.
Well, at least she does. You don't want that on your karmic record. You really don't. A person's gender, to repeat it, is inseparable from biological sex. The Catechism states that sexuality affects all aspects of the human person in the unity of his body and soul. Therefore, while biological sex and gender, or the socio-cultural role of sex as well as psychological identity, and some of these terms are being put in quote marks, can be distinguished, but they can never be separated. Should someone experience a tension between biological sex and quote-unquote gender, they should know that this interior conflict is not sinful in itself, but rather reflects the broader disharmony caused by original sin, and often results in the residue of social ills and cultural distortions of what constitutes masculinity and femininity. Such persons should be treated with respect and with charity, and no one should suffer bullying, violence, insults, or unjust discrimination based on such experiences. However, charity needs to be understood, confirmed, and practiced in the light of truth. And thus, such persons should be encouraged to seek harmony between their biological sex and gender, quote, in quote marks, not through a rejection of one or the other, but through turning to Christ and to all that the church provides. Only by turning to Christ can one acknowledge and accept one's sexual identity in every aspect, physical, moral, social, and spiritual. And only through such an acceptance can the human person, in turn, experience the freedom promised by Christ. Respect for creation is also respect for one's biological sex. As Pope Francis writes, it is enough to recognize that our body itself establishes us in a direct relationship with the environment and with other living beings. The acceptance of our bodies as God's gift is vital for welcoming and accepting the entire world as a gift from the Father and our common home, whereas thinking that we enjoy absolute power over our own bodies turns often subtly into thinking that we enjoy absolute power over creation. Learning to accept our body, to care for it, and to respect its fullest meaning is an essential element of any genuine human ecology. Also, valuing one's own body in its femininity or masculinity is necessary if I am going to be able to recognize myself in an encounter with someone who is different. In this way, we can joyfully accept the specific gifts of other man or woman, of another man or woman, the work of God the Creator, and find mutual enrichment. It is not a healthy attitude, which would seek to cancel out sexual difference because it no longer knows how to confront it. I'd like to pause there for a minute. Although they didn't use the term nominalism, there is a school of thought that is known as nominalism, and it can take a variety of forms, but from a philosophical or human anthropology, you know, the human person as such standpoint, nominalism is the view that there are only like individual things. There are no real categories of things. So there is no such thing according to the nominalist worldview. And many people hold this view nowadays without even knowing the word nominalism. They've never studied the philosophical underpinnings of this worldview, but they nonetheless hold it. And that would be a rejection of categories like male and female. So the nominalist project or the nominalist worldview entails this radical sense that everything is simply individual. You are an individual you. And you can be whatever you decide you want to be. That would be a hallmark of those people who have become infected, I would argue, in terms of their ideological biases. They've become infected with this misunderstanding of reality. Continuing. The following policy. So that all of that theological and human anthropology discussion paves the way now for this third page, which is the policies that are in place forthwith as a result of this document being promulgated. So here's the policy section. The following policy seeks to provide guidance in applying the church's moral teachings regarding the challenges presented by gender theory, quote unquote. This policy is put forth for parishes, organizations, and institutions of the Catholic Church in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. As a general rule, in all interactions and policies, parishes, organizations, and institutions are to recognize only a person's biological sex. This policy applies, but is not limited to, all church employees, personnel, volunteers, and those entrusted with the care of the church, including all contracted vendors when they are on site and may have contact with those entrusted to the care of the church. That would be, and this is my addition to this commentary, this would include things or people such as students, or patients in hospitals and other medical settings. Designations and pronouns. Any parochial, organizational, or institutional documentation which requires the designation of a person's sex is to reflect that person's biological sex. No person may designate a quote-unquote preferred pronoun in speech or in writing, nor are parishes, organizations, or institutions to permit such a designation. Permitting the designation of a quote-unquote preferred pronoun, while often intended as an act of charity, instead promotes an acceptance of the separability of biological sex and quote-unquote gender, and thus opposes the truth of our sexual unity. Again, this is all under the heading of policy. Bathrooms and locker rooms. All persons must use the bathroom or locker room which matches their biological sex. Archdiocesan parishes, organizations, and institutions are permitted to have individual-use bathrooms which are available for all members of the respective community. I think, by the way, this is my addition, that is a very relatively easy way to accommodate and to avoid problems. It would be to have single-use bathrooms as opposed to, you know, the common ones, especially in schools where you've got multiple stalls, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe part of the cost of accommodating this new policy would be to simply retrofit these bathrooms to be single-use bathrooms. Could be done. It would cost some money, but it could be done, and it would help to resolve a lot of these potential problems. Okay, attire. All persons are to present themselves in a manner consistent with their God-given dignity. Where a dress code or uniform exists, all persons are to follow the dress code or uniform that accords with their biological sex. Now, some of the yahoos on Twitter, I noticed when they were yucking it up when this came out and attacking it, one particular nincompoop, he says, well, what about cassocks for priests? You know, kind of making fun of cassocks as if they were dresses, which, of course, they're not. Athletics and extracurriculars. Participation in parish school and extracurricular activities must be conformed with the biological sex of the participant. Some sports and activities may be open to the participation of individuals of both sexes. Single-sex schools, buildings, and other programs and institutions. Admission to single-sex programs, including but not limited to single-sex schools, camps, and retreats, is restricted to persons of the designated biological sex. Dormitories or other single-sex buildings are restricted to persons of the designated biological sex. This is so basic and obvious and true. It's so common sense. It's so naturally, self-evidently true. And yet, believe it or not, and I know it's easy to believe, there are people out there who are howling in indignation.
Yeah, here's one. This is the last straw. I'm now a former Catholic. The church is interfering with the Jesus I know and love. Jesus would not condone this.
Oh, my. I'm tempted to say something, and I won't. Because I'm a nice guy. Thank you, Cyrus. You really don't want that on your karmic record.
You really don't.
You really don't. Okay. Medication. We're almost done. There's just two more bullet points here. Actually, no, one or two more. Medication. No person is permitted to have an on-site or is permitted to have on-site or to distribute any medications for the purpose of gender reassignment. Also, students and those entrusted to the care of the church are not permitted to take quote-unquote puberty blockers, even if self-administered, on parish or school property with the purpose of potential or actual gender, quote-unquote, gender reassignment. Protecting the vulnerable, those entrusted to the care of the church who express a tension between their biological sex and their quote-unquote gender, and others directly affected by this tension, such as parents, guardians, etc., should be directed to appropriate ministers and counselors who will help the person in a manner that is in accord with the directives and teachings of the church. Parishes, schools, and other Catholic institutions or organizations should take the necessary precautions in accord with the policies of this document to avoid bullying and to protect the integrity of those who may express tension or concerns about their biological sex. Now, there's a section after that. That's the end of the document. There's a section on resources, and there's also a glossary, and that can be read very briefly. So I'll read that to you quickly, then we'll take a break. Biological sex is defined as the sex with which a person is born, regardless of acceptance or perceived identity. Gender, as understood by the church, gender is the socio-cultural role of sex, and particularly how it informs one's psychological identity. Gender dysphoria is the state in which a person claims to experience an incongruity between physiological identity and biological sex. And lastly, and then we'll take our break, the definition of gender ideology or gender theory, an ideology or theory that denies the difference and reciprocity, an important word there, in nature of a man and a woman, and envisages a society without sexual differences, thereby eliminating the anthropological basis of the family. Thus, quote-unquote, gender ideology or quote-unquote gender theory promote a personal identity and emotional intimacy radically separated from the biological difference between male and female. Consequently, human identity becomes a choice of the individual, one which can also change over time. Ideologies of this sort, which seek to respond to what are at times understandable aspirations, manage to assert themselves as absolute and unquestionable, even dictating how children should be raised. It needs to be emphasized that biological sex and the sociocultural role of sex, aka gender, can be distinguished but not separated. All right. Cyrus will get this posted for you. Definitely worth your time to read and share this document. And I would like to offer my heartfelt congratulations to Archbishop Listecki and to whatever staff members were involved in the drawing up of this very helpful, timely, and necessary document. Thank you for doing that. I'll be right back.
Ooh, I don't want that on my karmic record.
No, I really don't.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
We are back, and thank you for listening. Keep in mind that we're in the midst of getting our Fast for Life. What would we call this? We're mobilizing lots and lots of people all around the world, in fact, for the Fast for Life. And what that means is you can go to relevantradio.com/fast and use the hashtag Fast for Life on your social media posts It's a way to let people know that you are going to participate in some manner, whatever it may be, fasting in some way from something. It doesn't necessarily have to be food. And I'll give you some examples of what some people are doing. But when you go there, go to relevantradio.com/fast and tell us how you're going to participate. Because, of course, the March for Life coming up, and we're doing this in solidarity with all the unborn children. And to be quite frank, in mourning for all the unborn children who have been killed as a result of legalized abortion. But this would be a way to let everybody know how you plan to participate. Be creative. Also, we'll send you a beautiful e-booklet on these very issues. And I have it right here. It's beautiful, well done, attractive, chock full of information. And we'll send that to you immediately for free. No charge, no questions asked. When you go to relevantradio.com/fast and sign up. Here's some examples. Julie from Attleboro, Massachusetts, she said, I'm not going to have any tea all day and nothing sweet, and I'll be adding prayer. Shansi from the Bahamas says, I'll be fasting the lunchtime meal and praying for the successful march and an end to abortion. So what is your creative way to participate in the hashtag Fast for Life campaign? Go to relevantradio.com/fast and let us know. To the phones, let's go to Dustin in Sacramento. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning. How you doing?
I am well, thank you.
What we're talking about with the document with the sex and gender and all that made me think not too many people talk about the health risk involved with sex change.
Well, you're so probably right about that. You're probably right about that. There is a guy named Walter Hoyer who has a website called Sex Change Regret. And he goes into many of those specifics, and he gives statistics of the rate of people, not only in areas such as suicide, but also in terms of medical problems and other physical problems that arise from sex change operations, which he himself underwent. He was a man who presented himself as a woman for years, and then he made the journey back, and he's trying to help people understand why they should not go down that road. Are you familiar with his website, Dustin?
No, actually, but I will look it up.
Yeah, Sex Change Regret. I think you'll find it very helpful. It's filled with good information.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Dustin. Good to talk to you. Thank you. How about Maria in Illinois? Good morning, Maria.
Hi, Patrick. Hi. My question is about an episode in the life of St. Francis. We were given a book published by Paraclete Press, and I thumbed through it, and I thought it was okay, so I gave it to my son. It's a comic book or graphic novel called St. Francis and Brother Duck.
Okay.
And after reading it, my son came to me and said, Mom, is it okay to ask God to speak to you by opening the Bible at random and putting your finger on a passage? And I said, no, that's a superstitious practice. And he said, well, St. Francis did it. And I said, where did you hear that? And he told me, he showed me the book, and of course, there it is depicted. And it turns out it was a real episode in St. Francis's history. It's recounted in the Catholic Encyclopedia, but I didn't know what to say to him about it because, I mean, the practice was condemned by the church. And this book also, it actually goes so far as to characterize St. Augustine's conversion as sort of the same practice, the tole et lege moment.
That's what I was going to bring up, is that St. Augustine had the same experience when he had his profound conversion experience. I am not aware of the church ever, quote-unquote, condemning that as a practice. I'm not quarreling with you, but I'm just unfamiliar with that. Where did you see that?
Well, I mean, also in the Catholic Encyclopedia, it's called Sortes Sanctorum. It's also called, sometimes it's referred to as Sortes Biblicae. And it was condemned by several synods.
Well, okay, that's actually new information to me. I'll have to go back and read the article on that in the Catholic Encyclopedia. But, I mean, I would put it this way, Maria. If it's being done in a frivolous or superstitious way, sure. You should avoid that. You shouldn't do it. But you can, I don't mean you personally, but somebody can be superstitious with a crucifix or a statue of Mary, but the church doesn't condemn the use of images simply because they could be used for superstitious purposes. So my sense is that this would fall into that category. that indeed this is exactly what happened to Saint Francis, also happened to Saint Augustine, and for all I know, there may be any number of other saints for whom this was a real phenomenon, where the Lord did speak to them in a powerful way through what seemed to be a random selection of a Bible verse, but it wasn't random in God's providence. So my view would be there's nothing inherently wrong with it, but if, like holy images or statues or miraculous medals or candles, I mean, if somebody were to start viewing them or using them in a superstitious manner, well, that, of course, should be, that is condemned, it should be avoided, but not the thing itself. I can see value, as we've seen in the lives of those saints, with that. So without ever having thought about this before, I think you're the first person ever to ask me this question, Maria, but that's my initial take on that based upon this information we're discussing. What are your thoughts?
I'm really not sure, because the practice seems to have been condemned. I mean, it was condemned on pain of excommunication for clergy in the 400s. And so it just, I mean, it struck me as strange, because I thought somebody as deeply connected with God as St. Francis would have been, would have approached the idea, you know, of where to get his rule. He would have gone about it through prayer and fasting, not some sort of random superstitious trick. It just,
but I would argue that in his case, it wasn't a random superstitious trick. I mean, and I'm sure you know the story of St. Francis. That's practically all he did, was fast and pray for years after his own conversion. So it wasn't devoid of fasting and praying. It was based upon fasting and praying, if you ask me. And he certainly was not doing anything superstitious. He felt led by the Holy Spirit to do what he did. And I mean, it's a bona fide, I mean, it was approved by the church, the rule that he drew up for the Franciscans. So here again, right. I think I can see your point, and I understand your concern. I don't want you to think I'm minimizing your concern. If there is a superstitious intention, or let's play a game, you know, let's have fun, let's see what, mm-hmm. you know, then yeah, absolutely, it should be avoided. And I suspect, without having read those canons from the regional councils, I suspect that they were probably condemning that practice of superstition and frivolity. But, you know, it couldn't, in my mind, rise to a blanket condemnation, because then Augustine would be condemned for it, and St. Francis and others. So I think there must be a middle ground here.
I don't know. It's honestly kind of confusing to me.
Well, maybe this can help. I don't know. For me, it seems helpful. Maybe it'll be helpful to you. If we substitute that issue of randomly opening a page of the Bible and then saying, this is something that the Lord says to me. And keep in mind, by the way, everything in the Bible is something the Lord is saying to you. So everything that's in there is intended for you. It is a message from God for you. So if you fling open the Bible and put your fingertip down on a random passage, well, strictly speaking, that is indeed a message from God to you. Does it have some special import on this particular day? Well, maybe not, you know, but all of what's there is intended as a message for you. So I would keep that in mind. But here's the thing I think might be helpful to make it less complicated, and that would be sacred images. You have, chances are, a crucifix in your home. You probably have images of Our Lady and maybe other saints. And that's good. And the church encourages that, because it's part of our way of, with our senses, drawing near to the Lord and thinking about him and the things of God. But clearly, the church at the same time also condemns any superstitious use of religious images. And there are Catholics, sadly, who do fall into superstition, and they invest in the plaster or the wood or the marble. They invest some, you know, superstitious supernatural powers that they don't have, and that's wrong, and the church condemns it. So the church would condemn that intention of using the images that way, but would not say, therefore, because some people would do it in a superstitious manner, therefore nobody can have any images at all. It's a both-and proposition, and I'm simply suggesting that the same approach, I think, is the right approach to this particular issue. But I can leave it at that.
Okay. All right.
Anyway,
well,
food
you.
For thought. Food for thought. You get a blue ribbon today, Maria, because I've never been asked that question before in my many years of fielding questions. So thank you. You've added a new one.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I think it's cool that your son, how old is he? And he's reading the story of St. Francis of Assisi?
He's 10.
That's great. That's really good. For what it's worth, Maria, when I was his age, I profited greatly from reading the lives of the saints. My mom and dad had a very big, very expansive library in our home. Hundreds, maybe over 1,000 books, many of them were Catholic in nature. So the lives of the saints figured very prominently in my young life. And I'm grateful that my parents had those resources for me. So kudos to you and your husband for doing that.
Good to know
we're
on the right track then.
Yeah, I think you are. Yeah, I think you are. Well, God bless you. And thanks for the call. We're going to take a break. We'll come right back. My number is 888-914-9149. Cyrus, put on your thinking cap. When I come back, I'm going to ask you, what do you think is the most dangerous job in the United States? The most dangerous job in the United States. I'll give you a hint. It's not radio producer, okay? So put on your thinking cap, and I'll tell you the answer when we come back from this quick timeout. Relevant Radio runs on horsepower, your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep our stations running. Join in with hundreds of other listeners who have donated their used vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, Cyrus. Okay, so I told you I was going to ask you. So you've had a couple of minutes to prepare yourself. I was going to ask you, what do you think is the most dangerous job in the United States? And I will tell you it's not radio producer. It's not even on the list.
Is radio host on the list?
Amazingly, no. No, not, there's nothing radio related that's on the list. This is from Statista, by the way. They deal in statistics, and they draw the statistics in this case from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics under the heading, the most dangerous jobs in the United States. What do you think the most dangerous job is in these United States?
I honestly have no idea. I have no
idea. Throw a dart.
I have no idea. Being a police officer.
Actually, no. You would think, right? You would think, but it's not.
All right.
So, do you have a drum roll for me?
Well, can you give me a hint? Or are you just going? You're going to.
I'll give you a hint. I don't know if you've done one, but you've done the other. Chances are. Most kids grow up doing, well, a lot of kids grow up doing both.
Mowing the yard?
No.
Paper route?
Did you ever go fishing?
I have, yes, I have gone fishing.
So have I.
That is not a dangerous job.
According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the number one, now this is the number of deaths on the job per 100,000 workers. This is as of 2020. This is kind of a combined job. The number one most dangerous job in the United States, it's twofold, fishers and hunters. And they have 132.1 deaths on the job for every 100,000.
Oh, this isn't talking about like fishing with your grandpa out on a lake with, you know, leaves everywhere and the sun's going up. Or this,
well, I mean, unless you're getting paid for that.
You're talking about like Alaska fishing boat and falling off over the side and freezing to death.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
That sounds terrible.
None of which ever happened to me when I was a child fishing, you know, in streams. I didn't fish very often. I fished who knows how many times, not that many. But I fished. You fished. Hunting, of course, so they have them lumped in the same category, fishers and hunters. So these would be people who, for their livelihood, that's what they do. Second, most dangerous job in the United States per 100, and this is per deaths per 100,000 workers. Want to take a guess?
Yeah, Patrick, tell us.
Want to take a guess?
I'm so far off on the first one.
You are. Okay, loggers.
Loggers. Okay, all right.
And I can see that. I mean, I can kind of see the fishing and hunting thing too, but the loggers, when you're out there and something goes wrong and a tree falls the wrong way and you don't get out of the way, I mean,
Yeah, it's not like there's a hospital around the corner either. Right. You're up in the mountains.
You might be 100 miles from nowhere. Yeah, so 91.7 loggers per 100,000 died. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of loggers there are, but roofers, number three, 47.0 deaths per 100,000 workers. And I could see why. Gravity, of course. You're up there on the roof, one wrong step, and off you go. Aircraft pilots and flight engineers would be the next one down. No, I take that back.
Do you get on your roof still? Do you get on your roof to get the leaves out?
Or when I was a younger man, I did.
That's where I was going. This last fall, I was like, you know what? I think this is the last year I'm doing this.
We have an extension ladder that goes up like a million feet. And I used to, because, you know, we have a two-story home, so I used to get up on this extension ladder. I felt like I was 500 feet in the air to change, like, the light bulbs way at the top for, like, the back patio kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Nancy will not allow me to do that anymore.
Good for her. Smart lady.
Yeah. No, she's smart, that's for sure.
All right.
But but one of the reasons why now that I'm a certain age, I don't get up on the roof anymore is because I have sons who are young fathers. And they're sure-footed goats. They can get up and do that stuff for me.
Sure-footed goats.
Have you ever seen a picture of a mountain goat like on a vertical cliff, like 1,000 feet up, and it's just sitting there chewing its cud because it's resting on like a 1-inch outcropping?
It's incredible.
It's amazing. It really is. Okay, so I skipped one category. So below roofers, that's number three. Then helpers and construction trades. So if you're swinging a hammer, if you're cutting lumber, if you're nail gunning stuff, you're in that category. Below that would be aircraft pilots and flight engineers. And I'm guessing that's probably not so much commercial airline related, because thankfully the number of fatal accidents on commercial airlines has dwindled to, you know, statistically very, very small. Maybe it has to do more with like flight instructors and things like that. Below that, this was a surprise for me. I must admit, I was really surprised that the next one in terms of the most dangerous jobs in the United States would be garbage collectors and recycling collectors. So, you know, the people who run down the street in the big truck and they pick up the garbage from the garbage cans, apparently that's a very dangerous job. Below that would be iron and steel workers. And below that would be delivery and truck drivers. So nothing about radio, and I'm happy to see that.
Woo!
Yeah. You can breathe a sigh of relief. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Hans now in Oakland, California. Good morning, Hans.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
My question is, could the chosen one in Jeremiah 49:19 be the same as the Antichrist before Christ comes, of 2 Thessalonians?
What was the first passage again? I need to open to it.
To the chosen one in Jeremiah 49.
No, what was the passage? Jeremiah 49. Okay, pardon me? Got it. I just wanted to turn to it. Okay. Verse?
Verse 19.
Okay.
I'll read it.
Okay.
Behold, he shall come up like a lion from the swelling of Jordan against the habitation of the strong, that I will suddenly make him run away from her. And who is the chosen man that I may appoint over her? For who is like me, and who will appoint me the time? And who is that shepherd that will stand before me? In the next verse, therefore hear the counsel of the Lord that he hath taken against Edom, and his purposes that he hath purposed against the inhabitants of Teman. Surely the least of the flock shall draw them out. Surely he shall make their habitations desolate with them. And then in the other verse was, says in 2 Thessalonians 2:3, let no man deceive you by any means. Are you there?
I'm here. Are you
let
there?
Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's any connection?
It's possible. I mean, I would need to study the commentaries on Jeremiah chapter 49. Immediately after that commentary about this lion coming up from, I'm looking at the Revised Standard Version, the jungle of the Jordan against a strong sheepfold. It certainly doesn't look to be somebody who is regarded in a positive light, but immediately after that is the prophecy of the destruction of Damascus as a city. And so that, of course, hasn't happened yet. Damascus hasn't, the destruction of Damascus, as foretold here and elsewhere, hasn't happened yet. So presuming that the Damascus prophecies pertain to the end times, then in context, it would not be surprising to me if those authoritative commentators on these things were to make a connection between verses 20 and 22, or 22-22, maybe having a connection with the Antichrist. It's certainly possible.
I heard the when the Antichrist comes, he'll prove himself through scriptures.
Through what?
Through the scriptures themselves. He'll prove himself to be the Antichrist.
I don't think so. The Antichrist is not going to really care about scripture other than maybe, you know, trying to get people to disobey it. The Bible says that he will show himself with mighty deeds, with miracles or pseudo signs and wonders. But at least as far as the Bible is concerned, I'm not aware anyway of any passage that says that the Antichrist will prove his credentials, so to speak, by quoting scripture, unless there's a passage I've missed. I'm not familiar with that. Well, interesting stuff, Hans. Thank you. There are many good commentaries on the end times. And I don't know if you've had a chance to read some of the books. Like there's a book called, what is it called? It escapes me. I forget what it's called. I think it's something like Coming Soon. And it is a Catholic survey of biblical prophecy about the end times, so including personages such as the Antichrist and the beast and things like that. So I'll tell you what I'll do at this next break, Hans. I'll run down the name of that book exactly and the author, and then when I come back on the other side of the break, I'll announce what it is in case you're interested. Thanks for the call. By the way, Cyrus, FYI, it's been announced that the IRS is partnering with a Virginia-based private identification firm that will require, get this, facial recognition in order to access your online account with the IRS. So let's say you want to go on irs.gov and get a document or upload a document. You're going to have to start using facial recognition as of this summer. Did you know that?
What?
I know. Check it out. According to Crebson Security, the IRS announced that by the summer of this year, the only way to log on to irs.gov will be through ID.me. Founded by former Army Rangers in 2010, the McLean-based company has evolved to providing online ID verification services, which several states are using. And by several, it's 27 states already that are using this service, providing states to help reduce unemployment, pandemic assistance, and avoid pandemic assistance fraud. There are currently 64 million users reported. Some of these 27 states are already using this ID.me to screen for identity thieves applying for benefits, and the IRS is joining them. The service requires applicants to supply a great deal more information than typically requested for online verification, such as scans of your driver's license or other government-issued ID, copies of a utility or insurance bill, and details about your mobile phone service. You know, typical stuff that you like to just
And it was already such a out. Smooth process. I mean, this is only going to streamline it.
Oh, yeah. When you don't have one or more of the above, or if something about your application triggers potential fraud flags, ID.me may require a recorded live video chat with you.
Lucky.
I know. Just think of the fun you'll have. Now, this is according to the security firm, Crebson Security. They're saying this. It's not from the IRS, but they're saying that the IRS has bought into this. After uploading images of your driver's license or your state-issued ID or your passport, if your document gets accepted, ID.me will then prompt you to take a live selfie. See the fun you'll have? You'll take a live selfie with your mobile device. I wonder if you can use, what are those Snapchat filters where you can turn yourself into a puppy?
Give yourself little doggy ears and, whiskers.
I wonder if you, I mean, my one of my daughters, she did that pictures of me where it turns you into an old man.
No, that was just a regular,
It was picture. Funny. And there's one that turned me into a younger man with long hair. Kind of fun. Anyway, so that's happening. If you want to read about that and your new requirements for the IRS coming this summer, we'll get a link to that article on the show page, which is relevantradio.com/Patrick. I'm about to start hour two. I'd love to have you with me for the experience. Call me at 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
All righty then.